VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
Nigeria depends heavily on money from its oil exports. But businesswoman Ifedolapo Runshewe has identified another local resource that brings in money: used car tires. Last year, Runshewe set up the Freetown Waste Management Recycle Factory in Ibadan, a city in southwest Nigeria. Workers there turn old tires into material used for paving bricks, floors, and other goods that are in high demand in the country. Creating something new from something that will otherwise be lying somewhere as waste was part of the motivation, Runshewe told Reuters. Waste removal systems are poor in Nigeria. In villages, towns, and cities, large amounts of waste are a common sight. People often burn the waste at night because safer removal methods are not available. Tires are often found among the waste. The Freetown factory depends on people who collect old tires from areas where waste is left. They are paid 70 to 100 naira, or 17 to 24 cents, for each tire. Some tires are also supplied directly by automobile repairmen like Akeem Rasak. He told Reuters he is happy to have found a place where he can make some money from old tires. Freetown started operations with just 4 employees. The factory now has 128 workers. So far, more than 100,000 tires have been recycled into everything from speed bumps to soft paving for playgrounds. Housam Azam is the founder of the Lagos Jet Ski Riders Club. He bought paving bricks from Freetown for a children's play area. It is important to support anybody that recycles in our country, he said. Azam added, taking tires and turning them into what children can play on, I think it is a win-win for everybody.
Environmental activists say protecting native people and their right to ancestral lands is critical to saving the rainforest in Brazil. The activists argue that the Amazon natives are its best guardians. The activists spoke Monday at a Reuters Impact conference about the future of the Amazon rainforest. They said the government of Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is weakening the rights of natives. What we are seeing is an attack on indigenous people, on their rights, their lives and territories, said Leila Salazar Lopez. She is the head of Amazon Watch, an environmental group based in Oakland, California. Ginger Cassidy is director of the Rainforest Action Network, based in San Francisco. She said the actions of the Bolsonaro government have continued to increase deforestation. She said the government is decreasing environmental protections, although it has promised to protect the forest. Deforestation of the Brazilian Amazon area has risen sharply since Bolsonaro took office in 2019. Early data show forest clearing decreased by 1.2% from January to August. But destruction remains at a level not seen in Brazil since 2008. Bolsonaro spoke at the United Nations General Assembly last month. In his speech, he promised to increase resources for environmental enforcement by 100%. The Environment Minister said last month that hundreds of enforcement agents would be added to the fight against illegal deforestation. But critics say the government has reduced spending on environmental efforts for years. Both Salazar Lopez and Cassidy have urged banks and other investors to respect indigenous land rights. They want financial interests to get the permission of native communities before they start projects that influence their lands. The activists called on private industry to stop the expansion of oil concessions in the Amazon. The rainforest around the Amazon River in South America is the world's largest. It is also considered very important to fight climate change. Salazar Lopez said forests are being cut down on purpose to clear land for cattle and soybean farms. She said the government's Indigenous Affairs Agency, called FUNAI, has decreased under Bolsonaro. This has left indigenous areas unprotected and in danger of illegal operations to cut down trees and to mine gold. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
A Chinese scientist has shared some details about moon rock samples the country brought to Earth late last year. The samples were collected by China's unmanned Chang'e 5 spacecraft, which launched to the moon on November 23, 2020. It returned to Earth 24 days later, bringing back about 2 kilograms of moon rocks and dust. The material was collected from an area known as Oceanus Procellarum, or Ocean of Storms, on the western edge of the near side of the moon. The area is believed to have had intense volcanic activity in ancient times. Some of the samples were collected from the surface, while others came from a drilling operation that reached about 2 meters deep. The mission made China only the third nation to collect lunar samples, following the United States and the Soviet Union. The last such mission happened in 1976, when an unmanned Soviet spacecraft collected 170 grams of moon material. America's Apollo program, which first put humans on the moon, landed 12 astronauts over six flights from 1969 to 1972. Those missions resulted in astronauts collecting 382 kilograms of rocks and soil. Scientists from China's Lunar Exploration and Space Engineering Center have been examining the new samples. They are seeking to find out how old the material is and what compounds it contains. The team hopes the information can help answer questions about the moon's past volcanic history. It may also provide information about when the moon might have lost its magnetic field. Some of the samples were sent to China University of Geosciences, where doctoral student Uji Chen took part in the examinations. Chen recently provided information on the material during a presentation at the Europlanet Science Congress. Chen described the moon samples as very diverse, saying they included several different kinds of rock material and minerals. About 90% of the material was considered local, meaning it came from the landing site or its immediate surroundings. Chen said the local samples were mostly made up of mare basalts. These dark gray rocks are believed to be the result of ancient volcanic activity that took place over much of the near side of the moon. This finding was expected because of what we already know about the moon's history. But the scientists noted that the other 10% of the material is considered exotic. These samples contain very different chemical substances than the local materials, the team reported. Chen said among these are distant impact materials that could have landed in the area as a result of space objects hitting other areas. The team identified other exotic parts of the sample as volcanic beads. A statement by the Europlanet Society on Chen's findings suggests this material might be linked to areas already identified as volcanic eruption sites. One of the sites could have been up to 230 kilometers away from where the Chinese spacecraft landed, the team reported. The statement said the samples may help scientists better understand records of other parts of the lunar surface, as well as hints of the types of space rocks that have impacted the moon's surface. The exotic pieces may also provide more information on the age of the area around the Chang'e 5 landing site, it added. all of the local and exotic materials among the returned samples of Cheng-E-5 can be used to answer a number of further scientific questions, Chen said. I'm Brian Lin.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In the middle of the 1850s, the United States was again struggling with the issue of slavery. The dispute centered increasingly on Kansas, a territory in the middle of the country. In Kansas, white men were able to vote on whether they wanted slavery to be legal in the territory. Many Kansas settlers opposed slavery. Some of the settlers were Northern abolitionists. They believed that owning another person was immoral. Many farmers also opposed legalizing slavery. They did not want to compete with slave labor. But many people in the nearby state of Missouri wanted Kansas to permit slavery. Slavery was legal in Missouri, and many Missouri slave owners wanted to live next to a territory where slavery was legal. So when Kansas held elections, pro-slavery men from Missouri crossed the border and voted illegally. Yet their votes were accepted.
The result of the territorial elections is that you have a territorial legislature that is overwhelmingly pro-slavery. It will write a slave code for Kansas. It will say Kansas is a slave territory. Slavery is protected here.
Nicole Etchison is a historian. She says the newly elected Kansas legislature created strong laws to protect slavery in the territory. The laws said no Kansan could speak or write against slavery. And they said people who tried to help slaves escape could be put in jail or executed. The lawmakers also demanded that President Franklin Pierce dismiss the territory's governor, who opposed slavery. The president agreed. He appointed a pro-slavery governor instead. Anti-slavery settlers in Kansas grew angry. They felt they could not get fair treatment from the president or the new governor. They said pro-slavery groups cheated to control the elections. So the anti-slavery settlers took an extreme step. They formed their own government. Their political group was known as the Free State Party. Its members wrote their own constitution. They also chose their own governor. Historian Nicole Etchison says Free State members refused to recognize the bogus authority of the official Kansas legislature.
That is the argument that the free state political movement will make. Not so much that slavery is an awful thing, although some of them make that argument, but that free white settlers in Kansas have had their political rights at the ballot box denied.
President Pierce said the actions of the Free State Party seemed revolutionary. He said that if party members attacked any government property or official, party leaders should be charged with treason. Pierce gave the pro-slavery governor of Kansas control of troops at two army bases in the territory. The situation threatened to turn violent at any time. In November 1855, a pro-slavery man killed a free state man in a dispute over land claims. To answer the attack, free state settlers threatened the killer and burned his house. At the same time, hundreds of pro-slavery men crossed the border from Missouri. They planned to burn the town of Lawrence, where many free state members lived. The pro-slavery governor and the free state governor agreed to hold an emergency meeting. They negotiated a settlement, and the men from Missouri went home. But the truce did not last long. In the weeks that followed, a pro-slavery sheriff attempted to arrest the leaders of the free state government, but failed. A few days later, the law enforcement official was shot. Around the same time, a pro-slavery grand jury found several free state leaders guilty of treason. The grand jury also said the town of Lawrence was supporting illegal newspapers and a hotel that stored weapons. Pro-slavery officials moved to take control of the town. The wounded sheriff urged private citizens to help. Once again, hundreds of men, including many from Missouri, gathered in Kansas. Once again, the target was Lawrence. This time, however, there was no truce. On May 21, 1856, a group of pro-slavery men marched into the town. Historian David Potter describes the incident in his book, The Impending Crisis. He says the mob entered Lawrence with flags and flying banners as if it were a victorious army. Some men threw two newspaper printing presses into the river. Others freed as much alcohol as they could find. And Potter writes, the group turned five cannons on the Free State Hotel. The mob fired the cannons at the hotel and burned the house where the Free State governor lived. But no anti-slavery settlers were killed. The only person killed was a pro-slavery man. He died when part of the Free State Hotel fell on him. Anti-slavery newspapers called the attack the Sack of Lawrence. In other words, they suggested that pro-slavery raiders had completely destroyed the town. A settler named John Brown heard about the attack on Lawrence. Brown was from the eastern state of Connecticut, but he had recently moved to Kansas. He strongly opposed slavery. He also thought the free state government was too weak. So John Brown persuaded four of his sons, his son-in-law, and two other men to answer the sack of Lawrence. Brown believed that the battle against the forces of slavery must continue, and he believed that God had chosen him to lead it. Late at night, Brown and the other men went to a settlement near Pottawatomie Creek. They went to three homes and seized five pro-slavery men.
Took these men out of their beds, defenseless, unarmed, and hacked them to death with broadswords.
Historian Nicole Etchison explains that Brown's group seized the men, murdered them, and left their bodies next to the creek. The event became known as the Pottawatomie Massacre. The combination of the sack of Lawrence and the Pottawatomie Massacre frightened both pro- and anti-slavery forces. Both sides believed they could be attacked at any time. They began collecting weapons to defend themselves. In the summer and autumn of 1856, the competing forces repeatedly threatened each other. They forced each other off land. They burned each other's houses. More people were killed. The territory became known as Bleeding Kansas. Nicole Etchison says the term Bleeding Kansas was evocative. In other words, it made people feel strongly.
The term is so evocative because it's a propaganda term.
Ms. Etchison says that many people, especially in the North, were against slavery in the territory. These individuals used the term Bleeding Kansas in their newspapers to gain support for their cause. The Kansas-Nebraska Act and the violence that followed also gave birth to a new political party. Its members called themselves Republicans. The Republican Party was an unusual combination of groups. It included former Democrats who were angry that their party had supported the Kansas-Nebraska Act. They believed the Democrats were allowing slavery to expand. The Republicans also included members of the old Whig Party. The Whig Party had lost badly in the elections of 1852 because its members could not agree on whether slavery should be legal. Anti-slavery Whigs found a new home in the Republican Party. The Republican Party of the 1850s also included voters who did not support immigrants, especially Irish Catholics. These nativist Republicans wanted to protect the rights of American Protestants. All Republicans were united, however, in their opposition to slavery in the Kansas and Nebraska territories. Some Republicans were abolitionists. They wanted to ban slavery everywhere in the United States. But the majority of Republicans had no interest in ending slave labor in the South. They simply did not want slavery to spread to other areas. Nicole Etchison says that white Southerners did not respond well to the new party. They believed that all Republicans were like John Brown, the anti-slavery settler who had murdered five pro-slavery men.
White Southerners do not see the distinction between a Republican Party that says, we don't like slavery, it's immoral, it shouldn't expand, and a John Brown who says, I don't like slavery, it's immoral, and it ought to be overturned by violence.
In 1854, some Republicans from the state of Illinois asked a politician named Abraham Lincoln to serve on their committee. Lincoln refused. He did not like slavery, but he still supported the Whig Party. 2 years later, in 1856, the Republicans nominated a presidential candidate for the first time. He was John C. Fremont. Fremont had explored the American West. He had been a senator from California. He was young and exciting. Republicans thought he was the right man to lead their young and exciting party. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.